almost like cooking without a recipe, just going with a couple ingredients at a time and trusting that you'll arrive at a meal. That's pretty much how I paint. And every time it feels like I got lucky, you know, because I didn't have this template, which I think is really exciting for me. I think it would overwhelm a lot of people. And for me, that's the exhilarating part. The not knowing what you're gonna do is like, for me, what painting is about.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to the Austin Meyer Podcast. I'm your host, Austin Meyer, and on this show, I interview the world's best storytellers in all sorts of genres about how they craft the stories they tell. On this week's episode, my guest is Maya Resnick. Maya is a prolific artist currently based in Roswell, New Mexico. Primarily a painter, Maya's artwork often explores the impact of trauma. She touches on themes such as violence, abandonment, memory, mythology, and despair. Born in Bosnia and Herzegovina in 1983, Maya immigrated to the U.S. with her family in 1995, settling on the West Coast, where she eventually went on to study at the University of Cal Berkeley, where she was also a member of the varsity track team, where she ran the 800, 1500, and she also did cross country. After her time at Cal, Maya received an MFA from the California College of Arts. Maya has exhibited internationally. She is a 2018 Hopper Prize winner, and her work has been written about extensively, most notably in Art Maze magazine, Juxtaposed, San Francisco Bay Guardian, and New American Paintings. I am so excited to share this episode with you all. While editing episodes, I always cut out little sound bites for social media. So as I'm going through the edit, I'm like cutting out little portions and I'm like, oh, that's awesome. And the sound bite folder for this episode is packed. There are so many moments during this edit that I found myself pausing and just thinking, wow, that is powerful. That is insightful. And yeah, I'm so excited to share that with you. I mean, Maya is incredibly thoughtful, introspective. And in this episode, she really lets us into her brilliant creative mind and creative process. So whether you are an artist yourself or telling stories in any other genre, there's so much to learn from her. Also, if you want to see her paintings before listening to this episode, which might give you a little bit better idea as we go, kind of have a picture in your mind, I'm putting a link at the top of the show notes where you can quickly browse some of her paintings just to get an idea before we go into this conversation, if you want to check that out. In this episode, Maya and I talk through the step-by-step process of how she creates her paintings, how she cultivates her authentic voice by resisting the pressures of what art should be or should look like or what's trendy. And I ask her for both the creatives out there and the people who say, the often remarked, I'm not a good artist, what advice she has to help us unlock our creativity. So I hope you enjoy my conversation with Maya Resnick. All right, let's get started. Maya Resnick, thank you so much for joining the Austin Meyer Podcast. It is an honor to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor. The honor is all mine.
All right. Well, so you are coming to me from Roswell, New Mexico, right?
That's right. Yes.
So how would you describe Roswell? I've never been to Roswell.
Yeah, well, this is my first time here. And I grew up in the Bay Area, so I would have never in my wildest dreams believed I would actually like living here. Roswell is a small town. It's very conservative politically. So it's very different than where I grew up in the Bay Area and going to school at Berkeley. But we came here because my fiance, Josh Hagler, received the Roswell Artist in Residence Grant. And that basically set us both up with a year of paid housing and, free housing and free studios. All of our utilities were paid for, and Josh even received a stipend. So that was our main draw. So even though it's a small place that a lot of people, even in the art world, don't know about, this foundation here is incredibly supportive of artists. So that's why we love it. There's a ton of space, and we're currently living in alumni housing that they have for artists who choose to stay, where we pay very little for, again, for two huge studios and a three-bedroom apartment and parking spots, all of that. So we love it here, not in terms of what it has to offer culturally, but in terms of what it has to offer for us to make the work we both feel compelled to make. And that was really hard to do in California, a state I love, but it just became so expensive that being an artist, I watched my friends take on full-time jobs in corporate America because they couldn't be artists. And it wasn't something I wanted to do. So moving here was something I did for my art.
Is there a community that's kind of been built around the residency where you have a lot of other artists who you're close with and there's community out there?
Yeah. And I think if it wasn't for the community, it would be much more difficult. I mean, we have artists here coming in every couple months. So all the artists are staggered and there are six at a time throughout the year. So they're coming from New York, from Brazil, from all over the world. So it feels really diverse in that way. You know, it's not like it's stagnant.
Yeah.
And then the alumni housing where we are now, there are artists who've been here since the 80s. So some are older than we are with a lot more experience. Some are our age, some are younger. So it feels really dynamic despite the fact that it's so removed from the, you know, the cultural hubs like New York and LA. And so we feel satiated in that way.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
So what is your studio look like? I think because when I think about like my creative space, and I'm kind of still in the place where I'm trying to figure out what does my space need to look like for me to get into the like most creative mode. I'm curious. So you said you have a living space and then you also have studio space. So is this separate and what is it? What does it look like? How do you create that space to foster what you want to do in there?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. So I feel really lucky that I have a 600 square foot studio now, and I've never had anything that large before. And I feel that most people, myself included, you kind of develop the work that the space allows. So when I was living in San Francisco, I painted in my room because I couldn't afford a studio. And then after a while, I painted in a garage. And then after a while, I had a studio in the Mission District, but I didn't have any windows or any natural light. So during that whole time, my work was quite small. I didn't work with toxic substances like I do now. Like I work with oil paint. The work was, like I said, mainly small and really kind of quick because I had a lot of part-time jobs. So I was never in the studio for a good chunk of time, like even 5 hours. It was always like in these little 2 to 3 hour bursts. So since moving to Roswell, I have this huge studio with a ton of natural light, with a fan. So if I want to dump turpentine or Gamsol overnight so that my paintings can have that stained look that I want, I can. I just turn the, you know, the fan on and I open up the windows and I don't have to worry about my health because I go home. I have the space set up into different stations. So I have a works on paper station that's quite small. Then I have a slightly larger sculpture station where I work on my fabric phantoms. That's what I refer to them. There are these little figures. And then the largest amount of space is dedicated to my oil painting. And I learned about the station approach actually by teaching kids. What I learned is that they like to move around and their creativity changes, you know. I don't know if it's their attention span when they're young that's not fully developed, but I think I have a pretty short attention span with my work because I don't use any references. I don't even look at my own drawings. So everything I put on the canvas is pulled out of me, which can feel really exhausting. So after an hour of painting in this really intuitive way where I have to be super focused, I can't even listen to music with words. It's all instrumental. I feel like my brain really hurts. So then I go sit down and I draw. And after that, I go to stitching and working on the fabric dolls. And then by then, I'm kind of refreshed to kind of get back at the oil painting, which kind of feels more like a monster because they're big and they're physically demanding. You know, I bend down a lot. It's almost like I'm doing 50 squats an hour, just kind of moving throughout the... So I learned that the only way I can stay in the studio for, you know, like an 8-hour day is if I give myself different things to do.
Interesting. So you are working on multiple art projects at a time, but they might be in slightly different mediums. Or are you working on, you know, 10 oil paintings at once? How do you kind of
Yeah, that's a great question that? Also. A lot of painters, well, I don't know, I wouldn't say a lot, but some painters like to work on more than a piece at a time because they feel that if you are only working on one thing, you have the chance of kind of ruining it and overworking it. So I've tried working on multiple oil paintings, but what I found for me is that I lose that sort of relationship with it that I develop. And the metaphor I would use is like having one dance partner versus a couple. Yeah. And I just, when I'm dancing with oil paint, I just like that one dedicated partner. And so instead of starting a new oil painting, I'll just go do something else. But I like to stay connected to the medium, to one project that's a specific medium at a time.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
I also feel like that activates different parts of my brain. And I like that variation. It's like I'm opening up different doors throughout the day.
Well, it sounds like even as you're describing it, those different forms require not only a different mental space for you, but actually a different physical relationship to that art you're creating.
100%. Yes. Yeah. I sometimes, when I feel exhausted, physically exhausted, and I run a lot still, and I exercise. So sometimes when I'm sore from my run, I'll just say, okay, well, today's a drawing day, or or if I'm just feeling sort of mentally sluggish, I feel like I have to be 100% alert and present for the oil paintings. I can do the two mediums that allow me to be a little bit more lazy.
Yeah. Yeah. That's nice.
Yeah.
So before we get into describing more about what your artwork is and how you create these incredible paintings, I thought it'd be useful to hear a little bit about your backstory, your personal journey to where you are now, because in a lot of ways it seems like that context is really important for the art that you make.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of people ask me, you know, do you think you'd be making this work if you didn't have your experience as a kid? And I don't know. That's a really interesting question. I don't know if I would be making the same work if I was born in San Jose or something, you know. But so basically, I was born in Bosnia when it was called Yugoslavia, still in 83. And there was a civil war in the early 90s, in 1992, which forced my mom and I to flee. And we lived in various refugee camps for a couple of years, finally arriving in the U.S. in 95. I didn't have a father figure around when I was growing up. My parents separated before I was even born due to ethno-religious differences. My mom's side of the family is Muslim, and my biological father's side was Bosnian Christian Orthodox. So I think that's interesting to say, in the sense that even though it was in the 80s when they were together, the tension that eventually led to the civil war was already kind of bubbling up, in the sense that, you know, their families wouldn't accept each other for that. So I think the kind of absence of a father and having a lot of women around, has a lot to do with the work I'm making right now, which I feel like is all about this kind of feminine power, that we often associate with the intuitive and the subconscious and, maybe stuff that's underneath the surface. And I think also living in refugee camps, you know, in really small spaces with a lot of other people, made me feel very afraid at a time when I think it's really important to feel safe. So this is between the time that I was 7 and 10, or 8 and 10. And I think that kind of fear, the physical fear, not knowing where we would sleep that night or not knowing what we would eat, created a sense of a true sense of being afraid of being alive. And I think it's the first time when I kind of started thinking about being a human being is difficult. And I think in that sense, it was very acute because we were refugees amongst other refugees. But I think in general, I think, you know, being a human being is really difficult. There's a lot of pain and suffering. And as a kid, I felt that acutely. So trauma is something I deal with in my work. And more specifically, I'm interested in how it's manifested in the body and how it's expressed and the kind of space between emotion, feeling, and language. Because a lot of people who experience trauma, they often, not always, but they end up developing addictive behaviors and self-destructive behaviors. So that trauma sort of literally gets its claws in their skin and they try to self-medicate, things like that. So I'm interested in what that is. What is that switch in the brain or in our bodies that make us feel like it's difficult to go on? And then recently I became interested in like that on an epigenetic level, you know, how trauma is transferred in our DNA. So I've been reading a lot about the ancestors of Holocaust survivors and, you know, experiments they do with animals where they expose the mother, to, adverse experiences, you know, where they're shocked or, I mean, it's cruel, what they're doing with the tests, but they're basically looking at what's going on in their DNA after they're exposed to something traumatic. And what they're finding is that their offspring who never experienced that still show fear to that stimuli. And that's really interesting to me.
Did you have an artistic outlet or a relationship to art when you were growing up?
You know, I would say not in like a way... Not in the sense that my mom sent me to like art classes or I took piano or things like that, but I was always around creative individuals. So my grandfather, whose house I grew up in, was a basket weaver. So one of my favorite things to do before the war was to go sit with him in his little house, in a little shack in the back of the house, and watch him weave baskets. And I would pretend to do the same thing, you know, or he would try to teach me. And then my mom, she traveled a lot and she would go to Greece and other countries in Europe and always come back with books about mythology. And I was really excited. And I think I was always drawn to kind of scary things. Like I remember very vividly this one book where she brought me back and the image of Medusa. I remember loving it because it made me afraid of this woman with snake on her heads. So in that sense, I feel like the sort of the seed in me that enjoys uncomfortable or mythological or dark things was already there despite what happened after, you know? And then my mom, once we came to the U.S., what she does for a living, she refurbishes vintage clothing. So growing up in the U.S., we were always surrounded by fabrics and colors and textures. So to answer your question, was I exposed to it? I'd say yes, but it's kind of maybe in a way in which you wouldn't really think I'm exposed to art.
Right.
Per se.
Well, when did you first consider yourself an artist?
Well, it's interesting. I always enjoyed making art. And when I was in high school, I was really into poetry. So I even joined a poetry club. And I think that was actually when I thought of myself as being artistic, but it was through poetry, not through painting or something like that, because I was never the best artist in the art classes, but I always did really well in the poetry when I was writing poetry. And when I was in high school, I even won this National Scholastic Award and I flew to Washington, D.C. My teacher paid for it at the time and I met Bill Clinton, who gave me this award.
Wow.
So I was like, wow, I had no idea. And it was even published in this anthology. So I would say that was the first time when I felt that I had something inside that if I'm as honest as I can possibly be, people enjoy. And even the poems that I wrote at the time, they were dark. They were about the day I left Orashia, the little town I'm from, the doll that I lost, my sister being born in the refugee camp. So I'd say, you know, the Maya themes were already percolating around the time that I was like 13, 14. And in a way, I've never really changed what the work is about. It's just that I arrived at painting. So when I ended up at Berkeley, I got into the school, and I ran track there. Track was really my main love, and I wanted to be an Olympian, but I soon realized I wasn't talented enough.
What was your event?
I ran the 800 and the 1500, but I'd say I was probably better at cross country.
Okay.
I was better at the longer distances. So I was taking art classes for fun, and by my junior year, a teacher of mine was like, "I see that you're not a declared art major. Why is that?" I said, "I don't know. I just like to take these classes. I found it therapeutic." Especially the year I had to redshirt because I fractured my tibia. I couldn't go to practice, and I was sort of depressed. And something about being in the art studio for a long time and making my mediocre paintings that no teacher really cared about was fine. Until my senior year, I had a teacher, Leo Bersemina, who nominated me for the honor studio. And I remember being so surprised, like, whoa, none of the other teachers really thought I had any special thing going on, but he did. And I remember I didn't get into it, even though I was nominated. But something happened to the student who got it that he had to leave. So I ended up getting the honor studio basically because the guy who got it dropped out or couldn't do it. And I remember, again, that affirming my belief that, oh, I'm not really meant to be here, but I'm just here. But I think it's because I loved it so much, and I didn't really care that it wasn't rewarded from the outside, that I kept doing it.
Yeah. And what about expressing yourself? Because I imagine you were probably touching on the similar themes that you had once written poems about. What changed about the way you were expressing yourself when you didn't have words? Because as someone who's more comfortable with expressing myself through words, having no words to express myself and just art would seem like intimidating, and like I would not have the tools to express myself, but maybe you saw and felt something different.
Yeah, that's a great question. I felt that I felt more comfortable with the language of painting and how abstract it could be. And you could make up your own symbols, and in your own mind, they can mean things that maybe the viewer doesn't, but that's okay because they'll have their own reading. In other words, I was very comfortable from the beginning with a way of communicating that was not verbal and that may not be so direct. You know, like words are, so if you say I'm thirsty, the person you're saying that to knows that they could get you a cup of water. But I found a poetry in that space that's not so efficient and direct that I felt was really rich. And I quickly abandoned writing, and I mean, I still love to read. And it's interesting, my fiance Josh, he loves poetry. He reads a ton of it. And I don't have the same patience for it that I used to, but he knows what I'll like. So he'll read me a poem every once in a while, and it'll really move me, and I'll get teary-eyed, and I'll say, "That's a poem," you know. And he was like, "See, Maya, you like poetry. You just need to know what to read."
Yeah.
So it's funny how like this thing, this medium of language that brought me into the art was something that I thought I didn't really know much about anymore because I invested so much in painting. And I think we do that all the time when we kind of train a muscle, we think we forgot that we still have that other muscle that we used.
Yeah. So for those who haven't seen your artwork, can you describe, and it's tough because we're just in an audio form here, but can you try to describe what your artwork looks like, kind of paint that picture for people? And then maybe you can walk generally through the process of making it.
So my paintings, I start out, so they're oil, that's the medium, and I start out by thinning the paint a lot with paint thinner. Gamsol is what I use. So I'll start staining the canvas after I prep it with gesso. And I sand in between so that the surface is really smooth. And I do that because I used to work with watercolor for a long time, and I try to create almost a watercolor surface with the canvas. And I do that by putting a bunch of layers of gesso, and I sand in between so that I can have that same kind of bleeding. So I'll do that in the beginning, and I'll think of a color or a mood, and that's pretty much my entry into the painting. So I'll start mixing various colors, and I'll sort of pour them onto the canvas and move the canvas around so these puddles of stains will collide and create their own shapes. And I just kind of leave it there to dry, and I'll leave it on the floor for a while, and then I'll set it up against the wall. And then as it's drying, I'll flip it around so that not everything is going in one direction. In other words, I don't want the gravity just to pull the stains in one direction. And usually that whole process will take an hour, and I'll have my cup of coffee, and I'll flip it around, and I'll sit down in my chair, and I'll sip my coffee, and I'll go back and flip it in the another direction. And this whole time I'm watching for forms to emerge, almost
and
like,
is this a common technique, or is this something that you just created kind of?
You know, I don't know. I don't think I'm original. I think a lot of abstract painters work this way. It's a very intuitive approach. But I don't think a lot of figurative painters paint this way. So I'd say it's a little unique in that sense.
Okay.
So the fact that I actually almost always have figures in my paintings that you sort of have to look for, but they're always there, it's a little weird, I would say. And again, I learned that from working with watercolor, where I would kind of have these little puddles and I would pull shapes out rather than draw them on. And I had a teacher at CCA who, I think he planted a little seed where he talked about painting as like pouring pancake batter into a pan versus outlining it. Like, you don't outline a pancake and then fill it in. It grows out. And I would say that's how I paint. I start like the pancake batter that grows out, and then I shape it around. And after those initial stains, I pretty much have to recognize something. And if I don't, it's actually very anxiety evoking, because it's almost like I made bad stains, which is absurd. But like from the outside, but sometimes I'm like, these stains suck. There's nothing to see. And that's usually when I'm like, okay, it's not that there's nothing in them, it's that you're not alert enough to notice where they are. So that's when I'll go to the other station. So then I'll come back, and then I'll see a shoulder or a foot or a finger, and I'll just start with that. I trust that if I just start working with a limb, or sometimes it's even the background, like a mountain or a tree, I trust that if I do that, if I articulate this thing that I see in the stains, that will tell me what the next thing will be. It's almost like cooking without a recipe, sort of like just going with a couple ingredients at a time and trusting that you'll arrive at a meal. That's pretty much how I paint. And every time it feels like I got lucky, you know, because I didn't have this template. Which I think is really exciting for me. I think it would overwhelm a lot of people. Like, Josh will sometimes go into my studio and he'll look at the stained canvas and he was like, I would not know what to do with that. What are you going to do? And for me, that's the exhilarating part. The not knowing what you're going to do is, like, for me, what painting is about.
Mm-hmm. And why do you start, you said you start with either, excuse me, you start with either an emotion or a color.
Mm-hmm.
Why are those the two things that you start with?
I kind of associate emotions with colors. I've always done that. I wouldn't call myself a what's the word? People who associate colors with sounds.
I can't remember.
I know. Like, I use this word.
I know what you're
all
thinking of, though.
I'm not. I don't think I'm that. But I have my own sort of symbolism in my head what certain colors are, and I don't know where that came from. And sometimes I'll you know, when I'm watching the sunset and a certain color in the sky will make me think of a memory, like a sweater that my mom got me when I was 7 years old. And then I think about that sky, the color in the sky, and that sweater and the feeling. And sometimes that will be the thing I start with, that feeling, which it's so not cool to talk about art this way in the art world, by the way.
Oh, really?
I went to a really conceptual graduate program, and it is like, throw the witch out, you know? But I feel comfortable talking about it this way for a couple of reasons. A, because it's the truth. And B, I feel like I've gotten enough support over the years to where I feel like I'm okay. You know, nobody's going to like beat me with a broom out of town or something.
Right.
So, and then I sometimes will have certain shapes that I have with emotions, like for feelings that are comfortable or emotions that are comfortable, the shapes are really round and open and not filled in. And for things that are dangerous for me, they're narrow, they're angular, they're in a corner. So I'll just kind of use my own dictionary, you know, of my own little symbols. And I use them when I want to create a certain feeling in the painting, when I want it to feel claustrophobic in a corner, or where I want it to feel open. So I would say that's my reference. You know, it may not be a picture I'm looking at or a model or something, but it's this kind of internal guide.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to hear you say that's kind of what you start with, because I reflect on my experience seeing your piece of art in my brother and sister-in-law's home.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's when you just like walk into the room and you just kind of see it on the wall in passing when you first see it, like your art either kind of evokes a feeling or a color. Like that's kind of like what I notice first.
Huh.
And again, I'm not much of an art aficionado.
Yeah.
But that's interesting that that's kind of what stands out to me. Like I can picture in my head like the color of that painting in their home.
Wow. Well, I'll tell you, this may be interesting because I talked about my grandpa, but that painting is based on my memory of the shack, of his shack, and sitting next to him and making baskets.
Oh, wow. Yeah, so I was going to ask, when you flip the canvas, the stain it started to stain the canvas in different ways, and you're almost sounds kind of like if you're lying on the grass looking up at the clouds and kind of looking for the shapes that present itself to you.
Yeah.
Are the things that reveal themselves to you, do you find that these are memories? Are they the person on the sidewalk that you walked past earlier that day?
There's this philosopher and psychoanalyst and artist who I'm obsessed with. Her name is Braca Ettinger. And she has this term called the matrixial border space. And she writes extensively about trauma, specifically memory. And she describes the matrixial border space as this theoretical space of where our memory is porous and our sense of identity is connected to not just our own past, but like everyone's past. And it's the space of interconnectivity where the matrixial border space really activates certain emotions. And I bring her up because I feel like that is what I'm trying to bring out in my paintings. I was painting this way before I learned about her and her matrixial border space, but I remember having this like, aha, this is it moment when I read her writing. I guess I'm trying to make these pieces that feel they're mined from my own personal landscape, internal landscape, but I hope that they're vague enough. And usually vague is used as maybe like a bad word, but or ambiguous maybe is a better word. It's ambiguous enough to where almost like this veil or this net of my own personal memories can activate the viewer's memory, in the sense that I wanted to feel like a shared moment, not about me. If that, even though it is about me, you know, you cannot make it about you as the maker. But and I try to do that by not articulating everything, you know, not spelling everything out like a tree is a tree, a foot is a foot, a desk is a desk type of thing, you know, but by keeping it abstract enough to where it's evocative rather than illustrative.
Yeah, that's really cool. And for the listeners, I was telling Maya before the show, I was really excited to talk with her because I feel some sort of internal conflict when I think about myself as just a journalist, and I think I gravitate towards filmmaking, which has a lot more artistry within it. And I can tell you, Maya, that like when I think about the type of work that I want to make, or the work I aspire to make, I want to include more mystery and ambiguity in my work. And right now that's uncomfortable for me because I come from a journalism background where that's not what you're supposed to do.
Right, right.
But I think it can be so powerful.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I feel, well, they're different jobs, right? A journalist has a different job than a filmmaker. Maybe not. I feel like, especially in today's political climate, things are so inflamed, and it's almost like people's borders are more outlined. Mm-hmm. You know, even and I feel like didactic work, or work that tells you how you think, or that just illuminates how you already think, is maybe not doing anything to us on a soul level. Mm-hmm. Like working. And I feel like the job of art is to like seep in rather than to be consumed. Because I don't know, I guess you have to ask yourself, well, what are you trying to do with the stuff you put out into the world? And, you know, a lot of people will say, well, I want to make a change. I want to put positive things into the world, you know? And it's really difficult to do that, even if you have like a very honorable goal. First of all, we have so much visual information out there that you have to sort of be competitive with, you know, especially with social media and Instagram. It's so easy to just to scroll by something.
Yeah.
But to make something that kind of makes someone like stop and look and think and want to see it in person, I think it's really hard to do.
How would you articulate your goal?
So in our family, we call certain feelings or states of mind as like being buttered. So we feel this way when we cuddle with our cat and it's like, oh, you guys are buttering. And or Josh reads me a poem and I get really teary eyed, I feel really buttered up. And what I mean by that, it's like I feel really soft. My own physical body feels soft. My eyes are like tender and I feel like love and just goodness. And I would hope that if my art could achieve any like a smidge of that on some level, this kind of buttering of the viewer, I would be very happy. And whatever that buttering is, you know, somebody might describe it differently than me, but my favorite art does that to me. It makes my physical body feel softer and I forget that I'm in a body, and it feels almost like a transcendental experience. You know, I don't meditate, but some people describe it during meditation, or the sense of not even necessarily being at peace, because some of my favorite paintings are really difficult paintings or art that I like. It does something to me chemically that it feels transcendental.
When I was moving from making videos, which are kind of like I'm always thinking about a sequence of events to tell a story, when I was trying to become a better photographer, I realized now I'm looking for individual moments. And for your paintings, do you see them as singular moments, or do you see do you create a painting and look at it and see a sequence of events that either led to that moment or that come after it, or kind of how do you see it on that spectrum?
Wow, that's a really good and difficult question. I don't know if I'm going to answer it, but I'll do my best.
Sometimes, I think this also gets to what you told me before we started recording, where it's, you said you don't see yourself as a storyteller.
I guess sometimes, well, often I feel that I only know what it is that I wanted to say after I make it. Back to the metaphor I had of cooking without a recipe, you know, where you are given just like flour and salt and pepper, and then you're given tomatoes. And you just have to trust that at the end, wherever these ingredients are coming from, like, you will end up with something interesting. But sometimes I do get little windows in the making. Sometimes a title will come before the painting is even done. A recent title of mine is called Sleep Seekers. And I was working on this painting, and I just felt that every figure that was depicted, and even had a couple amorphous animal creatures, everyone looked so tired and peaceful. And I was like, oh my God, they just want sleep. And then I started thinking about sleep as a metaphor, like, what is it? And, you know, the subconscious and dream logic and things that don't make sense, but in a way reveal deeper truths than when we're engaging our frontal lobe. So then once I came up with the title, only in the middle of the painting, it did help me make decisions. So at that point, it was not just about improvising. It was about continuing to articulate in a way where this title, Sleep Seekers, would sing.
What about for your paintings, as you've expressed, they are so personal, and they kind of come from your conscious and unconscious mind and kind of flow out of you. And I'm wondering, in what ways the outside world play into your artwork, whether you think about how the art will live in the current political climate, mm-hmm. or do you paint and think, well, I need to make a living, I gotta sell work.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how does the outside world influence the art you create?
Yeah, that's a really important question. I try not to think about what will sell when I make it. I will sometimes end up making a painting and I'm like, oh, this is gonna be I call it the sexy paintings. You know, where it's like, it'll please the audience. And Josh and I, we kind of feel comfortable enough where we say that to each other, like, oh, this is a seller, or, ooh, this one won't ever sell. Most of the time we're right. Sometimes I'm pleasantly surprised when someone likes something that feels really important to me, and then somebody's really moved by it. So that's my answer in terms of sales. You know, so it's not, I'm like, oh, I need to pay rent, let me make a painting that'll please the audience, because I'm not that commercially successful where I can really just do that. You know, there are artists who are really, you know, hot on the market where they could pretty much make anything and it'll sell right away. I'm not there at this point in my career. And then in terms of like political stuff, what's going on, they're inflamed right now. A lot of people are making work about Trump. Personally, I just can't. I have a really hard time looking at work that has face in it. You know, I don't feel compelled to be reactive. So I think that maybe we live in a time where the work that's really celebrated is work that's pretty reactive to the climate that we're living in. I'd say my work is because it's personal. It seems unimportant maybe to the larger political art world, but my personal belief is that the personal is political. So I think my own personal identity and my history is nuanced. So given the fact that I'm an immigrant, but I'm also white, is kind of a confusing, you know, the fact that I was a refugee, but I'm also like a tall white woman is also confusing. not everyone knows right away that I had the experience that I did. So if I make work about what I make work about, it's almost like, well, why are you making work about that? You well-educated white woman, you know? And then but I'm not interested in sort of like getting on a little soapbox and like yelling out that like I have an important story worthy of telling, because I won't do well in this race. I already know it, you know, because it is a nuanced history that I'm talking about. But I think in 10 years, in 20 years, because we will be inflamed with something else, maybe the art world will. It'll have more mental and emotional patience for stories that are like not headliners, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
So, you know, in that sense, I don't think I make work that's like gonna be a headline kind of story. But I'm okay with that, actually. I love that, because not having the pressure to be this hot commercial artist is really exciting, because I live somewhere where I get to make the work that I want to make, and I am lucky enough to where it sells sometimes, to where I can live off of it, and I'm very happy, you know. I don't need it to be more popular at the moment, you know. Like, if I grow into my popularity with years, that's actually is what I would want. But for right now, I feel kind of lucky that I'm not so desired, because I feel like the work can stay authentic. And I think that could be really hard when you have a lot of outside pressure and a lot of demand. I feel like it might be easy to kind of phone it in and just like throw anything up on the wall.
Yeah. I've heard a lot of filmmakers. I haven't really had this experience yet because I'm kind of just starting out, but I've heard numerous documentary filmmakers talk about how when they're working on a story for so long, they feel like they have this intense personal ownership over it. And then they put out into the world and suddenly it's like no longer theirs anymore. It's for it's the audiences.
Oh,
yeah. And I'm wondering if you feel that way. And then maybe you could talk a little bit about what is it like to share this in galleries, or to see people walk by your art and take it in? What are you looking for? What excites you? What's that experience like?
Yeah, I think I agree with what you were describing. Some of the filmmakers saying, like, once it's out there, it's no longer mine. I feel that way. Once I finish a painting, I feel like it's dead. In a way, like I'll use that word, because for me, it's alive while it's cooking, you know, while I'm making on it, while my body and mind and emotions, while it's involved, it's making decisions, it's engaged, and like we're together. And when I say it's done and I photograph it, something about the photographing it is, you know, how they say in some cultures, like if you get photographed, it takes your soul away. I kind of feel like that's the death of a painting. Once it's on that wall and it's photographed and it's like cleaned up and photoshopped and put out into the world, it's like, here's my dead little thing that I made. And in a way, I need to be that way so that I'm not like hoarding all my stuff, because I already have a storage full of my work. I don't need 10 others.
Yeah.
So it's good that it's out there. But the paintings, I've learned recently that I should keep the ones that mean a lot to me. So I have my favorite painting that I made last year in our house, and I don't want to sell it. Mainly because it wouldn't cost that much. Like it's only like 20 by 30 inches, and it would be $3,000, which is really not that much money. And the painting is worth more to me than those $3,000 I might get from it. So when I feel that strongly about a piece, maybe I won't even make it available. I'll just say not for sale, or I'll just decide to not photograph it and I'll keep it. Mm-hmm. But pretty much everything else, I don't have that sense of ownership or needing to have it. If anything, I want it out, because if there are too many of your things around, it almost feels like a disease. You know, it's like, oh my God, get it out of here.
Yeah. Why do you think that so many people say, I'm not a good artist?
Ah, yes. Well, I've taught adults and I've taught kids. And guess what? Kids don't say that. It's adults. And I think it has to do with what we believe art is. And sadly, it's often people think they're a good artist if they can make something look like it looks like in the real world, you know, if they can look at a photo of a tree and then make it look like that tree. And I think that maybe has something to do with how we're brought up thinking about art. I was really lucky in that when I was drawing as a kid and my mom never said, oh, that's gorgeous, that's beautiful. She actually, back to the storytelling, would ask me, like, what is it? What's going on in here? So it was never about its aesthetic merit, but more about what it is that I, what was it? Mm. So I think my personal taste was never about this kind of artificial beauty, you know, like this waterfall and a sunset and these pretty flowers. And I even see that when I showed my students, for example, when I was teaching at the college level, I show them my favorite artists and they're like, oh, this person can't even paint, you know, if I show them Philip Guston or something. And what they're looking for is skill, you know, this kind of thing that's impressive. And I think when people say I'm not an artist is that they feel that they can't make something that's impressive, which I think is just one characteristic that an art woke can evoke, you know, it can, or it can have like, wow, you know, has the wow quality. But that's not always the most interesting stuff. You know, some work can make you feel something that's not wow, but the opposite of wow, which is like, my God, that's sad, but I like it. Why do I like this sad thing? Mm-hmm. Or how is that color blue? Like my favorite artist is Rothko or one of them. And, it's just color, people would say. But there's nothing to his paintings. They're just red. And I think a lot of it is just like having the patience to sit in front of them and let yourself get buttered up by the painting. And then I think you'd feel something.
Mm. So how did you said you have taught adults?
Yeah, I've taught adults and college students, high school students, little kids with Ashley. I've worked with adults with intellectual challenges. Like Down syndrome and schizophrenia. And so I've
how did you as an art teacher approach that vulnerability that people have about not being a good artist? Like, what do you say to them or what do you encourage them to get them out of that mindset?
One thing I do is when I show them artists, I start most of my, well, it depends on who I'm teaching. You know, if they're adults, let's say college level or, you know, older, I'll start out with showing artists. If I'm teaching a figure painting class, I'll show figurative artists that I admire. And I always make sure to not just show, you know, the classical, the Renaissance, you know, the things that the average person thinks art is, you know. So I'll show mm-hmm. them art that is not part of the Western canon, for example, what we call outsider art, to really confuse their idea of what art is, you know.
Yeah.
And I do that on purpose, so that they don't think of this like classically rendered body as the epitome of it. And I think that helps. And when I still feel that they're stuck, I ask them what they want to learn in the class, because sometimes they do just want to learn how to make water look like glistening water, you know? And if I feel like I have the ability to teach them that, I do. And I could tell that they usually feel satiated with that and that that's what they wanted. In other words, I try not to ascribe what I think art does, which is it's supposed to be emotionally moving to everyone, because I've also learned that that's not everyone's demand of art. So I try to really see what they're looking for and then do my best to give that to them, because they're paying for the class. And as a teacher, I should be able to teach them the thing they want to be taught.
Was it a struggle or, yeah, I guess struggle, or maybe you could describe a little bit of your journey of finding your own voice, of pushing aside those expectations of maybe what art should be or should feel like, to really embracing what you have to say and the way you want to say it?
Yes. There's a particular memory I have, and it was when I was at Berkeley. I was a junior or a senior. I was in a figure drawing class, and like I was saying earlier, I was not like any teacher's favorite. I was not the best drawer. I was not the best painter. And we had this model, a nude model. She was there, and I was doing my best to kind of render her perfect thigh. And, you know, I was really struggling and I didn't really enjoy it. I really wanted to be loose. Like my body was like, you know, and I feel like a lot of teachers are telling their students to loosen up. I had the opposite problem. I felt like everyone told me to tighten up, you know? But there was a student who was a graduate student, and she was just kind of, she would pop into the class, and she was drawing really vigorously, and she was beautiful. I don't even remember her name or anything, but I just remember her being a goddess. She had like long brown hair. She had these cool boots, a big, like long dress, and she was just like drawing. And I remember going over when she went to the bathroom just to see what she was doing. And she was making these incredible drawings that really blew my mind, that were more like de Kooning than what any of the other students were doing. So it was like a...
Was more like what?
Like de Kooning, an artist who I really love. So they were loose and kind of gestural, and you could still see the body, but it was like opening and falling apart. And he was doing all... And I remember just like my heart start beating faster, and I fell in love with her and what she did for me that day. And I think she gave me permission, not that you need permission to be who you are, but she gave me permission to not be tight, you know, to not do this thing. And I think it also depends on who your teachers are. A lot of the teachers I had at the time, they were like these realistic painters. Who I don't think they liked the wild spirit I always had, or maybe they didn't, there was no judgment like it or not like it, but it wasn't encouraged, you know? And, so I think she did it for me. And then I started, it activated a part of me where I then started, when I would go to museums and galleries, I didn't care if I didn't like the things that everyone around me was liking. I would go and look at the Gustin paintings and the work that really made me feel a certain way. And I think that's when, where I realized, well, that's what's important. It's making work that makes me feel a certain way and hopefully makes the viewer feel a certain way. Yeah.
Cool. I think we have time for a couple more here on the main show. Okay. This one I'm very excited to ask you about. And that is, how has being a college athlete influenced your life as an artist? What lessons do you draw on from your time as a track athlete that now help you in what you do today?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that question, because I feel...
I think about it so much.
Yes. It's so connected. I think, again, I was really lucky, as somebody, I didn't have a father figure growing up, but I feel like I was really lucky to have had coaches and male figures that, became my role models. So while I was at Cal, my coach was Tony Sandoval, and I hope he listens to this. I'll send it to him. And he's still coaching there, and he was just a beautiful human being. He is a beautiful human being. So his approach to running was really, spiritual. Like we would often, we would do these visualizations as a team before races, where he would have us all lie down on the floor, and we worked on breathing and visualizing your race, everything from the gun going off to how your sweat is trickling down your face, to all of it. And just his presence was beyond, I think, what a coach can do. It was really like he was this beautiful protector of all us little runners, you know? And so that's that. I feel like I was around a lot of beautiful people when I was a runner. Magdalena Louis, who you mentioned earlier, she was always around, and she was just so possessed and passionate about what she was doing, that that was really inspiring and taught me that loving what you do is everything. So I'd say the way that running has is still a huge part of my life is that it's taught me to put in long hours, you know, just the ritual of doing the same thing every day, even if you don't feel like it, is important, you know? So sometimes I wouldn't feel like going on my 8 mile run, but you know, you just need to put in the mileage, you know, so you can have your 50 miles a week goal. So I think that's similar to being an artist for me, you know, going to the studio, even if you don't feel like painting, but doing something as simple as sweeping your studio floor and looking around and making some notes, or ordering your paint, stretching a canvas, doing kind of maintenance work, even if the inspiration is not at its highest. I mean, that's so much like being a runner. And I think the other thing is also listening to your body. I used to, as a young runner, I used to like run through my injuries, you know, so it would start out as shin splints and then it would become a fracture of my tibia. I feel that similar sensation as being in the studio. Sometimes you can really burn out. And if you don't know how to pace yourself and add elements to your practice that are fun, not just laborious, you'll burn out and it'll be really hard to stay in this and, you know, for the long haul. So the discipline of thinking long term, taking care of your body, you know, sleeping well, drinking a lot of water, stretching, you know, I stretch a lot in the studio. And then, you know, when I was a runner, all my friends were runners. What we did on Sundays would like meet up at Golden Gate Park or at Skyline, and we would run our 15 miles and then go get breakfast. Well, I'm surrounded by only artists now. So all we talk about is art. And so I see a lot of parallels for sure.
That's yeah, me too. And one of the things that I kind of hear when you're talking about your process of making art, and it's one of the ways that I feel like being a college soccer player and that being a huge part of my life has influenced me now, is this enjoyment of the process. I mean, even the way that you talked about, like, when it's done, in some ways it's dead. Like, even the way you described that, I mean, I think that would be so foreign to a lot of people. Like, where a common quote is like, I don't like writing. I like having written. You know, I know when I have something at the end. And I think that my experience as an athlete has really given me a deep appreciation for the process of just the amount of emphasis that went on to training, and how and how we looked at competition and the games as not this big moment of pressure, but almost like a celebration of all the hard work that we've put in leading up to that day. It's something that I think about a lot, because the process is hard and it takes a long time and it can be lonely at times. And if you don't enjoy the process, I feel, in some of these like artistic fields, you're going to burn out quick, because that's so much of what it is.
Absolutely. Yeah. When I was in college, I read this book called Flow by this Czech psychoanalyst or psychologist. I'm not even going to try to pronounce his name. It's like,
we'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah. Okay. It's like Mikhaili Czechoslav Mikhaili, but it's Flo, and I can send you a link too. But he interviewed a lot of athletes, artists, writers, scientists to talk about this idea of flow and when they feel most in flow. He called it like peak performances. And I remember reading it as an athlete, and I remember kind of looking at the book at my mom's house when I was visiting, and just kind of looking at the parts that I underlined. You could just substitute my love for running at the time with art, and it's the same. And what he was talking about, I mean, it's been a long time, so I'm not going to even try to paraphrase, but the idea is that maybe what all the people he interviewed had in common, even though they're careers or their jobs were different, was that they all loved this moment. What they loved most about what they do is how concentrated they have to be. And I feel that when I'm painting and when I'm really one with the process, it's like time stops and I feel like I entered this eternal time where it's complete union of my mind, my body, my breath, the brush, and it feels spiritual. And I've had a few races like that where I set like personal records and I won, and where it felt like I didn't do it. It felt like I was just floating over the track and some other force entered me. And I remember what that those races have in common with those moments of painting is just single pointed attention on one thing, which can like lead you into this meditative trance. And I think that's why when it's done, like that's over. And then I'm back into this world, which feels right. Not as magical as the moment I had with the painting or in the race.
Oh, so beautifully said.
Thank you.
Before we wrap up the main show with my final question here, and head into the post show, Maya, where can people check out your work if they want to follow what you're up to, what you're creating?
Yeah, I would say Instagram would probably be the best place because I upload it all the time. You know, I post something every day or sometimes twice a day. And I'm Maya Ruz. That's my handle. So it's MAJARUZ. Or on my website, which is pretty up to date, it's ontheedgeofreason.com.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
And Maya will stick around for the post show.
Sounds great.
So I encourage everyone, if you want to hear that, all you have to do is head on over to patreon.com/AustinMeyerFilms. And for just $2 a month, you get access to the post shows, additional episodes, all our guests usually stick around to answer some rapid fire fun questions. So if you want to stick around to a private podcast and hear questions, I'll ask Maya, like, what is her favorite color? Mm-hmm. Or what's the biggest misconception about the type of art she does? Head on over to patreon.com/AustinMeyerFilms and you'll get the link to that private podcast. Okay, but we're going to wrap up the main show with the question I like to ask everybody. Maya, what advice do you have for people who want to become better storytellers? And because we have this talk about whether you consider yourself a storyteller, mm-hmm. you can also broaden that out to what advice do you have for people who want to access that creativity that is maybe they don't have access to right now?
Yeah, actually, that question is easier for me to respond to for some reason. And I guess what I would say is pay attention to what you're already interested in. Some people say, I don't have any interests. And I don't think that's true. I think we all, our mind does something when it likes something or our eyes see something. And I would just say to pay attention to that and jot them down or take a photo of it. Living that way will also cause you to slow down, which I think is really important to be creative, to be a storyteller or a painter or a filmmaker, so that you can take more in. And I think when we just kind of move through life really quickly, you may not see that little kitten on the side of the street or, you know, that stranger that's smiling at you, that's going to ask you, that would ask you something if you met eyes with them, you know? So I think slowing down and just being more present and somehow documenting that. And I would say that if you then were to reflect on all the little things you collected for a month, you would start seeing themes that emerge.
Mm. That's great advice.
Oh, thank you.
Beautiful answer.
Yeah, I hope it helps.
Yeah.
And I think maybe the other thing I would say is like not to worry too much about telling stories that seem to be trendy. Molding your story to or your interest so that it fits the larger, because that'll actually just put you further away from your own authentic voice. So just trusting that your authentic self has more to give and that that's really ultimately what the world wants to hear, not some kind of imitation of something that's in.
Amen.
Yeah. There it is.
Amen. All right. Well, let's wrap up the main show here. Maya, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's been so fun talking to you.
That's it for episode 21 of the Austin Meyer Podcast. Thank you so much to Maya Resnick for joining the show, and thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. I know for me, it's just so incredible to talk with someone who thinks so deeply about why she does what she does, how she paints, why she paints, what impact she wants to have in the world. I think that that sort of self-awareness and clarity that she speaks with can only be developed through a lot of time spent with your own thoughts, through a lot of time in self-reflection. And that's something I'm definitely going to take from this conversation. That's something I'm thinking a lot about after having listened, to cherish that introspection, because I would love to get to a place where I can talk about the stories I create with as much thoughtfulness and care as Maya does. And as mentioned on the main show, if you want to hear even more of that thoughtfulness, Maya did stick around for about 20 minutes of post-show questions. So I asked her about her favorite brushes that she paints with, the book she has gifted the most to friends, and if she had to pick out of anyone, what three artists would she invite to a dinner party, dead or alive? What three artists would be at her dinner party? So if you want to hear that, all of it is available on the Austin Meyer Private Podcast, which is available exclusively for Patreon members. So Patreon is a monthly subscription service where for as little as $2 a month, you can get access to all our post shows and additional episodes of the Austin Meyer Podcast. In fact, I recorded an additional episode just this past week reflecting on my first film festival experience that just happened in Palm Springs. And I had a lot of thoughts from that experience. So if you want to check that out, the post show with Maya, all of this, and support the show, head on over to patreon.com/AustinMeyerFilms. You'll get access to the private podcast, and that will play in your native podcasting app. So it's super easy. All right, that's all I got. Thanks again for listening. I am so grateful, and I hope you're feeling inspired, just like I am, to go out there and create. So I'll see you on the next episode. And until then, go out and tell some stories.